Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. This year, our program turned 30, and one thing we thought we might do to mark the anniversary would be to bring back some of the oldest programs that we have in our tape collection. These are shows that feature some of our most interesting guests and that raise questions that we think are as important today as they were when we first had these conversations. And in most cases, these are shows that have not been heard since they were first broadcast. On today's show, you will be hearing from an economist and a sociologist, both of them quite well known, with ideas about what would constitute the ideal society. When the Soviet Union fell, many people argued that it was a victory for capitalism. One writer famously said it was the end of history, that forever after, capitalism would reign supreme. But to the critics of capitalism, the end of the Cold War was not a sign that all was well. People continue to ask whether capitalism had a future, and it is that very question that has prompted ongoing demonstrations against income inequality and the influence of big corporations in cities all across the country today. The future of capitalism was the subject of a show that we did back in 1993 with economist Robert Heilbronner. He is probably best known for writing about the lives of the great economic thinkers in his 1953 book, The Worldly Philosophers. And when we talked in November of 1993, he just published a book titled 21st Century Capitalism. Now, that book asked whether capitalism would prevail, and if so, what kind of capitalism. And we began by talking about the fact that some of history's leading proponents of capitalism, including Adam Smith and John Maynard Keynes, believed that eventually capitalism would collapse.
You know, everybody who learns this or first hears of this has something like a faint heart attack. I mean, how could Adam Smith possibly say such a thing? Actually, what Smith said were two very interesting and very disturbing things. He was one of the first to recognize that capitalism contained an inner momentum, a kind of impetus for growth, and he talked about the fact that the wealth of nations would increase as a consequence of giving rein to the forces of capitalism. But he also had two very interesting comments to make. One was he didn't think that this growth would go on forever. Now, of course, he was only writing in the year of the Declaration of American Independence, 1776, and he thought that a country would, given what he called the system of perfect liberty, increase its wealth until it reached some indefinitely distant time in which it had all the wealth it needed, as if you were a moderately prosperous family and you got richer and richer and after a while you had enough. So capitalism would reach that saturation point and stop growing, at which point, he said, it would go back downward again and become about as poor and miserable as one can imagine. Secondly, he thought that even while capitalism was growing, he never used the word capitalism, by the way, it hadn't been invented yet, but even while the system of perfect liberty was growing, it would exert some very serious side effects on the great body of the people. The side effects were the division of labor, the increasing fragmentation of work, which was really the secret of its productivity, which he thought would render, quote, the laboring man as stupid and ignorant as it is possible for a creature to become. So he looked with real misgiving on the likelihood that capitalism, first of all, would cease growing after a while, and secondly, that while it was growing, it would reduce the great body of the people to a condition of, contracted intellects, dwarfed understandings.
It seems to me that in the analysis of all of these men, the question that seems to come up again and again is the question of, are there limits to growth? And it seems, in fact, to be a question that now a great many people are asking. Are there limits to growth? And in fact, should we be thinking differently about how we define growth, progress,
well,
so forth?
I mean, you couldn't have raised a more important question or a more difficult one. I do indeed think that the question of limits of growth has always been in the back of the minds of people who thought about this system. I want to put a word in about the system. It is capitalism. Capitalism is a very difficult word to pronounce. Somehow it's fraught with political overtones. And in the old days, when you said capitalism instead of private enterprise, you identified it as some kind of a crazy person off to the left. Capitalism really means, in a manner of speaking, the business system that we live in, the way of organizing social life through markets, the way of having private enterprises rather than the state as the central organizer of effort, a system in which private property is celebrated and so forth. So capitalism has to be thought of in the first place in as something that we know at first hand. And when we think of it as something that we know at first hand, that we work in and come up against, and then we ask about the limits to its growth, we begin to see there must be problems there. I mean, is it imaginable that a society would successfully function if everyone in it were as rich, either in money or in material resources, as the richest person is today? It seems awfully hard for me to imagine. I mean, capitalism largely works because some people work for others because they need the money. And if everybody had all that money or all that riches, where would that necessary workforce come from? And secondly, there's the question of, can we really imagine a system in which all the forces of nature were exploited as completely as implicit in the idea of limitless growth? Can we imagine such a system coexisting with the limits of nature? I mean, the ecological problems, the depletion of resources, and of course the great question these days of global warming. So I think the great majority of economists, very few exceptions, recognize that there are bound to be limits or obstacles or barriers or difficulties that this business system must encounter as it gets richer.
Recognizing that fact and then pointing to where the limits lie are two different things. We can say in the abstract, yes, certainly there are limits to growth, and then turn around and say, but we have an almost unlimited future to run ahead of us. So I mean, how do we decide where the boundary lies, or is that even possible to do?
Well, that's another very, very good, very hard question. I think there are two different answers. One is, when you take the idea of the system as a whole, you recognize right away that that limits is a serious problem, and you have to cope with it. You have to think about what you can do to change the system, whether the system is changeable, whether it can eventually arrive at some plateau beyond which it won't impinge further on the environment. The other question, a much more down-to-earth question, is given the way the world is today, with the United States still the richest country in the world, and at its borders, Mexico, certainly not the richest country in the world, and beyond the borders of Mexico, the poorer countries of South America or the poorer countries of Asia, to whom Mexico looks like a fairly affluent country, then what are the limits of growth? What happens when the United States grows and impacts on poorer countries? What happens if the poorer countries begin to grow and impact upon one another? You begin to realize that the problem is partly one of the global question and partly one of the political question of adjusting different countries in different stages of development so that they can somehow reconcile their mutual path through history. And by the way, that's true whether it's capitalism or socialism or any other system you want. If China, whatever China may be these days, is successful in its current boom, it will also encounter these same kinds of limits I'm talking about. At a certain point, some people in China are going to say, are we pushing the absorptive properties of the atmosphere too hard? And others are going to say, can everybody push at the same rate? And if so, how is the pie going to be divided? So the question remains there in the future. Partly the future is quite close. We begin to worry right today about overrunning the capacity of the immediate environment, and part of the future is longer run. What will we do 25 years from now? What will we do 50 years from now if the momentum of the system is maintained?
I wonder if I could ask you specifically with one about one of the criticisms made of capitalism, one that you mention in the book as well, and that you say a number of the the authors that you examined all seem to share, I think your words are, a sense of disquiet with regard to the moral basis of capitalism.
Yes.
And essentially, I think what we're talking about here is that some people would argue that capitalism by its nature fosters inequality. That is, the relationship between workers and employers is not an equal one. The employers have the advantage, and what that leads to is a maldistribution of power, and along with that, a maldistribution of wealth. And again, interestingly enough, the quote that you offer is from Adam Smith.
I know the one you're going to say.
In the book, I won't read it all. It's about a paragraph, but I found it again quite intriguing, because if someone had set that in front of me and said, guess who wrote this, not being terribly well-schooled in economics, of course, my first guess would have been Karl Marx.
Yes, there's a sentence that goes, this is Smith, and I'm quoting by memory. The existence of one rich man presupposes 500 poor. Something like that. Mm. Amazing, isn't it? And indeed, Smith...
It's very striking.
Beg pardon?
It's indeed very striking, especially when you know the source.
Yes. And indeed, this moral unease, I think, is deeply connected with the realities of capitalism. And I have something to say for and against it. The first importance in the sense of sharing that moral unease, and against it in the sense of trying to put it in some sort of perspective. I certainly share the moral unease. Capitalism is a system which whose whole purpose is to accumulate wealth, and no one can walk through this country and not be shocked at the disparity of conditions between those who have made it to the top and those who have somehow fallen to the bottom. Whether or not the people at the bottom are necessary for the accumulation of wealth at the top is a more difficult question. I do indeed think that wealth comes from the profitable employment of people. Usually it's not the poorest people. The poorest people are people who have somehow fallen out of society and need redress and a helping hand from the government. But there's a large working class and a large middle class that works for business that are in some sense the source of the wealth that then accrues in disproportionate measure to the larger share owners, the top managers, and so forth. Mm-hmm. Now, by way of writing the balance to some extent, I don't know of any society except for primitive societies in which some sort of social equality seems to be the order of the day. What is interesting about primitive societies, there's a wonderful book that's available in paperback called The Harmless People by a sociologist called Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, and describing how the Kalahari Bush people and many others live in a society of shared endeavor. The men hunt, the women gather. They share the kill. They share the proceeds of the gathering according to well-established procedures that are governed by kinship and the rest. And the result is that there is, so to speak, enough for all. There is a difference. The person who brings down the buck gets the first cut, so to speak. But the rules of the game see to it that no one is left unfed. And aside from those primitive societies, I mean primitive not in a moral sense, but in a developmental sense, aside from those primitive societies, inequality has always been the order of the day. I mean, the basic fact of human history, once it passes beyond that early long stage of hunting and gathering and early agriculture, is that inequality is the manner in which power is denominated. Now, I suppose one asks, why is power so attractive to humankind? Why do people want to be rich? Why are people content to be within some reasonable boundaries of sharing? And the answer, I don't really know. Since I do know that societies exist without these great inequalities and without this tremendous institution of power, I know that it can't be blamed on something called human nature. It has to be blamed on the institutions of different kinds of societies. And all I can say is that every society which I know that has gone beyond hunting and gathering into what we call the state or civilization or stratified society, every one of those societies is a society marked by inequality. So you have to blame the institutions. And then you go back in a sort of endless regress, well, why is it in the nature of humans to invent these institutions, and I can't answer the question because, once again, you can point to most of humankind's existence on Earth in primitive societies in which power and inequality were not the most immediate form that struck the eye.
If you have questions, we do have a couple of people here lined up. Hello.
Yes.
I have I want to give a little background here and then see what you think. We've had some people sort of glorying in the failure of some other systems in the last few years, and the assumption is that somehow the model of capitalism which we have has therefore proven to be successful because the other systems have somehow failed. And the idea that I want to bounce off of you and reflect on is this, that is it possible that the capitalism, to the extent that it has succeeded in the U.S., and I recognize the failures, some of them at least, perhaps can only exist along with an ethic of generosity, you might say, because quite clearly not everyone has the same power, not everyone has the same wealth, this kind of thing. I'd be curious as to whether what you would think about that.
Look, I'm very sympathetic to that approach, and I would put it a little differently, only because the ethic of sympathy or generosity is, although very well-chosen words, something that it's very hard to find an institutional way of instantiating and putting into process. I believe myself that capitalism, with all its many warts and many faults, is very likely to be the dominant world system for a very long time, quote, a century. And I also believe that capitalism can take many forms, which I can sort of characterize by saying, on the one extreme, what I sometimes call slightly imaginary Sweden, rather egalitarian, very public-spirited, and all that. And on the other hand, an all-too-real America, once again, caricaturing the worst aspects of what we all know. And I think that capitalisms, Germany, France, England, the rising capitalisms in the Far East and so on, will position themselves someplace along a spectrum that you and I could agree on as going from, quote, good and successful capitalism to not so good, not so successful. I would put the crucial variable, not just in the ethic of generosity, but in the mutual relationship between business and government, and the private and the public sectors. The private sector is, of course, the motor of capitalism.
Well, in that context, I wonder, some of the things that are being proposed now, for example, the broader health care access question. It's a bit troubling when I hear, I guess, some younger people saying, we don't want to pay for this. And on one hand, I can understand their concern for efficiency. On the other hand, I think what's troubling is the sort of presumed justice of looking out only for myself.
I couldn't agree more. If I may, let me repeat a very brief story that's someplace in the back of this little book I have on 21st century capitalism. It concerns two nations, both capitalists, whose, quote, national character was largely formed in a shared historic experience. The historic experience was that each of them subdued a large contiguous wilderness. One of these nations is the United States, the West. One of these nations is Canada, the great Pacific West. And out of that very similar experience emerged, in some fashion that I cannot explain, but certainly do not deny, two very different national heroes. Out of the Canadian experience emerged the Northwest Mounted Policeman, with his scarlet jacket on his sleekly groomed horse, with his rifle slung across his, bringing law and order. And out of the American experience emerged the cowboy. And one could make other such comparisons between the national ethos of France versus Germany, Spain versus Norway. How do countries generate different spirits of sharing and generosity and responsibility? I don't know. I do feel that the United States has not done well in this regard. Maybe our 19th century experience, which was so successful, with individualism really riding, pushing the country so marvelously well, from poor beginnings to rich endings, served in the end to dampen what in other countries was encouraged as a kind of spirit of social sharing. I don't know, but I certainly feel very strongly with you that the ethic is very important. What I don't disagree with you. What I think is that the carrier for the ethic will have to be government.
And that's quite possible, of course, if it doesn't rise naturally from the individual.
Right. You know, and the trouble is that the two really come together. That is the role of government is very importantly determined by our spontaneous feelings about the role of the public and the private, and the effectiveness of government in the same way is limited or expanded by the way in which we receive it. So you posed what I surely think is a central question.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks to WILL for the foresight of bringing Dr. Halberner on.
Oh, we appreciate your comment. I have several other callers here, and I don't want to make them wait too long, but maybe I could just maybe ask a follow-up question.
Sure.
I suppose that some people might want to say that capitalism is inherently flawed and we ought to do our best to get rid of it and move on to some other system. But if we allow that, say, let's put that outside of the realm of possibility for the foreseeable future, if we wanted to, say, move capitalism into a direction that would make it more mature, more compassionate, if indeed such a thing is possible, how could we do that? What might we do?
I have the answer, of course. You got to vote in the right way, but I'm not allowed to say what way that is. No, we are in charge of our own fate in that way. We shape our social conscience to a very large degree through the political process. I mean, to a certain extent, it's shaped by our churches. To a certain extent, it's shaped by professors. It's shaped by just individuals who write books that go to the heart of matters and to the heart of people. But the government is the immediate agency, and we run our government through competing political parties. And to my view, some of those parties are much more aware of, alert to, quick to respond to the needs of the larger society than others. I am a deep believer in the democratic process. I mean, I vote for the party I believe in, and I believe in that party, among other things, or maybe primarily, because I think its best spokespeople share my general view about responsibility, about the concerns you're talking about honesty and trustworthiness and so forth. So I think there is always, I hope there is, always the possibility of throwing out the bad guys and putting in the good guys. And in that fashion, improving the tone. Look, there was a tone of American capitalism in the 1920s that was very different from the tone of American capitalism under the New Deal. There was a tone of capitalism, if I may say so, in the Reagan days that was extraordinarily careless, indifferent to the public well-being, and I hope that there may be a tone under Clinton that redresses those overlooked moral deficiencies. So I share with you, of course, the concern, and I turn, as I said before, to the political process as the way to keep capitalism on the right track. There are many tracks of capitalism. I think even the best of them has its problems, but we've got a long way to go before we get to the best.
Perhaps one last question, and unfortunately I can't give you very much time to answer it, but let me try it anyway. Acknowledging, as you do in the book, that making predictions about the future is difficult, you said earlier that you thought that capitalism would be the prevailing economic system at least for a century. What then?
Now, that's a good question. One quick answer is, who knows? But I think that I think there will be a spectrum of capitalisms, successful ones, unsuccessful ones. I think all of them will be beset by larger problems, which embrace them all, ecological problems and globalization problems. Who will emerge where on this spectrum? It's very hard to say. I don't really know. What the best will look like and what the worst will look like, I don't know. Whether the strains will become so great that, God forbid, warfare breaks out among them, I don't know. So but when you look very far into the future, beyond 10, 20 years, we're just pushing fantasies and guesses and hopes and fears. But I'm not worried about 25 years. I'm worried about the next 5 years. something can be done in every country, and certainly in this country, to bring out what there is here that can be put to good use and to minimize those things that are unnecessary and in the end destructive of our own well-being. At least so I hope.
That's Robert Heilbronner. He was a guest on this program. Back then we called it Focus 580 in November of 1993. We talked about his book, 21st Century Capitalism. He was, for many years, professor of economics at the New School for Social Research in New York. He died in 2005. This year, our program, Focus, turned 30, and to celebrate that fact, we have been digging into our tape collection, looking for some interesting people with things to say about important subjects. These are programs that are not currently part of our web archive, and in most cases, these shows have not been heard since they were first broadcast. We are calling it the Deep Archives Project, and you can tell us what you think by going to the Focus section of our webpage. Near the top, you will find a place that you may leave a comment. You can also drop us a line at 300 North Goodwin in Urbana, Illinois. The zip code is 61801. We'll have more after a short break. This is Focus.
Support comes from the Illini Union Bookstore, featuring a public lecture by Annie Leonard, author of the book and web film, The Story of Stuff, The Impact of Overconsumption on the Planet, Our Communities, and Our Health, and How We Can Make It Better. On Thursday, November 15th at 7 p.m. in the Union's I Rooms, A, B, and C.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. In the second part of today's Deep Archives program, you will be hearing from Robert Bella. He is a sociologist, probably best known for his book Habits of the Heart, a book that was published in 1985. Well, that book asked a very basic question: how ought we to live? And it concentrated on personal resources for thinking about our common life. Now, when Robert Bella was guest on this show, Focus 580, in November of 1991, we were talking about another book, one that had just at that time come out. And the title of that book is The Good Society. And it explored that same question, how ought we to live? But it looked at institutions like our economic system, our schools, our politics, our churches, asking how well they served us as we tried to answer that question, how ought we to live? And we started our conversation with some thoughts about the American commitment to individualism and how it sometimes conflicts with the idea of the common good.
Well, I think there's some deep ironies here because, as you say, individualism is close to the heart of American values and of our sense of who we are and what we're proud about. But the very individualism, which is our strength, has unleashed forces of rapid development, economic and otherwise, that have created large structures and tied us into a very complex world in which thinking only in terms of individual decisions becomes less and less viable. So it's almost as though the individualism that got us where we are is now limiting our capacity to deal with the realities of the world we live in.
Mm-hmm. Is it this perhaps is a question one ought to save for later, but I'll ask it now anyway, and perhaps we can, you know, get back to it too. Is it possible to preserve some kind of balance between individual and group needs so that we don't we don't lean too far in either direction.
Well, I think even the way you pose that question expresses a typical American anxiety that somehow there's a zero-sum situation. The more we think about larger institutions, the less freedom we have as individuals, and vice versa. Our argument is that that's really not an accurate description of the world in which we live. We strongly affirm the importance of the individual and of individual responsibility, but we argue that in the kind of world and society in which we live, individual responsibility to be effective has to be exercised in and through institutions. Now, if those institutions are working badly so that they block our participation and make it difficult for us to have our opinions heard and have our participation respected, that's indeed a problem. But the notion that the answer to that problem is just avoiding institutions or trying somehow to hide from them or escape from them is self-defeating. So we don't see it as an either-or. We think to be strong individuals today, we need to be individuals who can take responsibility in institutions, and when they're not working right, help to change them.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think that the kind of ideas that we have about individualism have indeed shaped or helped to shape the important institutions of our society, and that and not for the better?
To some extent, I certainly think that is the case. The emphasis on maximizing individual freedom and, in recent times, individual gratification has undermined every one of our institutions, first of all, for example, the family. If the notion is that marriage is only something that you enter as long as the other person meets your needs, and the minute you sort of scan the cost-benefit analysis and you find your needs aren't being met, you split, then that makes for a very weak form of marriage, and we see that in our divorce rate. If you feel that way about your church, your job, and everything else, then loyalty begins to collapse, and loyalty is pretty fundamental in any society. If there isn't loyalty, no institutions can operate well. The downward tailspin in our society is set off by the fact that as institutions work less well, instead of challenging them and strengthening them, our tendency is to withdraw from them and try and somehow make it on our own in a private life that has as little to do with large institutions or even small ones as we can. And then that weakens institutions further, and then we get more frustrated and so on, until it's really a rather bleak prospect. I think, for example, I know this is complex and we'll probably want to get into it later, but that's what's happening to government. People are so angry at government, they don't want to pay any taxes, they don't want government to do anything, and yet in a modern complex society, a weak and effective government is a recipe for disaster all across the board.
Why do you think it is that we have started to flee our institutions when we feel that they're not serving our needs or not serving the needs of all? Why have we run from them instead of trying to find out why they're not doing the job and trying to change them?
Of course, that's a very complicated question and involves a lot of history. I am not the kind of sociologist that thinks there are glib answers to those questions. Part of it, though, clearly has to do with the increasing affluence that we experienced in this country, particularly the period after the Second World War. I think as people moved to the suburbs, as they escaped the tenements, as they escaped to some extent the pressures, but also the rewards of the extended family, that this ideal of, you know, being free, having few obligations, and that was grew, and that was stimulated by the enormous increase in all the things we could buy that, you know, can put the headphones on and listen to the music and not be in contact with anyone else. We can have a microwave oven, so we don't need to have dinner with anyone else. We just stick a package in and eat all by ourselves. But much of the surrounding culture and its consumerism and its commercialism encouraged people to think of the good life as a radically autonomous life. And as long as the society was growing in affluence, that seemed realistic. When we enter tough times, it's not so great, and being alone and on your own and not having it, not being able to make it, is not so charming. And I think people are coming up against that now.
It's to me, sometimes I think one of most serious flaws of humankind is that we can have extraordinarily short memories, and that perhaps part of our problems now are due to the fact that we don't really seem to remember much of what life was like in this country before 1945.
Well, most of us weren't born before.
Perhaps that's to be expected.
Yes.
But that this, you know, this whole business of being able to think of the good life as being radically autonomous is something that came about as a result of a confluence of things that will probably that never happened before and probably will never happen again.
Right.
And yet we can't seem to quite get it into our heads that rather than that being somehow the high point of American civilization, that it was rather anomalous and is not doesn't really fit in with the rest of American history.
Mm-hmm. Some historians who are looking closely at the decade of the 30s, which of course was a decade of extreme economic depression and high unemployment beyond anything we've seen since, and tremendous problems that make, you know, our homeless today seem really not that severe. But they also point out that there were in place extended kinship networks, ethnic communities that really had solidarity and not just slogans, churches and neighborhood groups. The people pulled together in the face of adversity, and even with a certain cheerfulness and a certain sense of, yeah, we can survive this. And they're pointing out that so many of the things that made that possible in the 30s are so much weaker today, and our attitude towards an adversity, which at this point is not nearly as severe, though God knows what the 90s are going to be like economically, you know, it's mean-spirited. It's give nothing to the people on welfare. I don't want to pay any taxes. I don't want anybody to keep anything that I deserve away from me. And that's a set of attitudes that is not going to prepare us to deal with extended adversity at all well.
I guess one thing that I wonder about is how one gets people past the "this is the way it is; it's never going to change" position, because it seems to me that's a pretty fundamental thing. It inspiring people to even think about the fact that something could be different. Because if they don't even have that kind of attitude, then they're never going to take the next step and see about making things different.
Right. Because one of the things we argue is that our political party system is in very sad shape. I saw, I don't remember what magazine, because I see too many, but there was a big thing on the cover, "We need a second party." you know, we always say, "Oh, we need a third party," but it never works. But at this point, if you take something like controlling political campaigns, we find that the Democratic incumbents are protecting their own personal future and aren't any more interested in controlling these costs than the Republicans. So we don't have a party that could articulate that kind of deep, deep public concern. We find that everywhere, that people express just what your caller said, that it's the money that controls the election, so why should I vote? Or if I'm going to get involved in politics, I ought to find an organization I agree with and give the money to them and have the lobbyists in Washington do it because voting is meaningless. And that is that's a terrible situation. It strikes at the very heart of a democratic society, and it's so ironic that when we are the model of democracy for so much of the world, we're weakening our own democratic institutions. But as I say, if we don't have a party that will articulate that, if we don't have a notion of somebody in opposition to the way things are going that will give us another alternative so that if we go to the polls we can expect something to be different, if both the parties in so many things and many things that are close to people's hearts aren't giving us any alternatives, then that's a really very tough situation. Getting into party politics and trying to change that is tough and dirty, and most Americans sort of pull back, and they don't want to get involved in those things. We have seen on occasion social movements of various sorts, like the civil rights movement, that occur outside the political parties, but are able ultimately to put enough pressure on the political parties so they do sort of at the last minute pick up on these things and put some of the demands into practice. And I'm not sure what's the best way of going about it in the country today. But I do want to emphasize that the incapacity of our political parties to give us viable alternatives is one of the reasons why people are so turned off.
We continue. Let's go on to line number two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. The magazine you referred to a few minutes ago with the headline, "We Need a Second Party," was, I think, the recent issue of the Democratic Socialists of America journal. And that raised the question as to whether this second party should be in some part of the socialist tradition. We've got examples in Britain and in Canada of parties that at least in principle are critical of the business orientation, the business foundation of American Republican and Democrat parties. But we don't have any such party here. Do you see reform as rising from some principled critique of the way we control investment and productive property in this country, or is that an old issue?
I think in America, the word socialism is so and such an anathema that there's no use using it. Given the collapse of communism and the long-term negative meaning of the word socialism equated to communism in this country, though not in many other countries, socialism to Americans means a command economy. It means an economy that's run by some bureaucracy out of Washington. And we know that doesn't work anywhere, and certainly we don't want it in America. So I appreciate the idealism of people like Cornel West and the Democratic Socialists of America, who never meant a command economy, who mean a more decentralized and more democratic participatory economy, not a state-run economy. But I just don't think that the language works in this country. But the issues are real, and it isn't only people who use the word socialist to emphasize that we need a greater degree of economic democracy in the sense of a greater degree of a sense of participation by everyone in a corporation or a firm, that they're part of it, perhaps that they own a part of it, that they have a voice in it. And that can be defended on straight economic grounds. In parts of the world where people do feel that way, productivity is a lot higher than it is in this country. A modern economy needs loyalty, care, commitment on the part of everyone who works in a given enterprise. And treating those people badly, having a huge differential, as in this country, the CEO makes 100 times what the shop floor worker makes, whereas in Japan, the CEO makes 6 times. I mean, that's not a communist country. It's the most effective capitalist country in the world. But they try to encourage a sense of participation and loyalty in their economic life. And the idea that the CEO would make 100 times what the average worker does, that's out. That's crazy. From a Japanese point of view, that would just destroy the very thing that makes their economy vital. So there's lots to be done in this country to rethink the way we run our economic institutions that doesn't fit any kind of immediate American ideological notion of socialism.
We're down here to the point where we just have a couple of minutes left.
Okay.
One thing I would like to hear you talk about, the final chapter of the book is entitled Democracy Means Paying Attention.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you could just talk for a minute or two about what you mean by that.
Well, the average citizen has to be involved in a really democratic society. Now, we know a lot of people will never be, but at least a healthy sector of the average populace has to be informed, has to care, has to have some kind of enlightened understanding. We feel so overwhelmed with our personal life, with our problems, with the amount of hours we have to work, that it's very tempting in this country to turn off, to not read newspapers, to not even watch the news. One of the things we're saying is that that's very, very destructive to democracy. If we stop paying attention to those things that we have in common, to those matters that we have to solve as a society, then somebody else is going to pay attention and make those decisions for us. And before we know it, we won't even be a democracy.
That's Robert Bella. He was a guest on this program. Then we called it Focus 580 in November of 1991. And we were talking about a book that was new at the time. The title of that book is The Good Society. Today, Robert Bella is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at the University of California at Berkeley. This year, our program turned 30, and we were thinking about all of the programs we've done, all of the interviews, all of the interesting folks that have been on this show, and we thought one way that we could celebrate our 30 years on the air would be to dig into our tape collection, and these were cassettes that were stored in cardboard boxes, and we're sitting in our tape library, and programs that have not been heard, they're not on the web archive, but we thought there was good material there. So we went through looking for some interesting things to bring back, and that is why we decided to call this the Deep Archives Project, and we've been doing it since the beginning of the year. We'll do one more next month before we finish up the year. If you have some thoughts about these programs or anything that has to do with Focus, you can let us know in one of two ways. You can go to the Focus section of our webpage, and near the top, you will find a place that you can leave a comment. Or you can write us in the usual way, drop us a line, send it to Focus at 300 North Goodwin in Urbana, Illinois. The zip is 61801.